Chapter 36. It may have been the proximate cause of my sorrows. Without this stimulus to her vanity, she might have left me undisturbed. I don't know. All I know is, that over many men Agalma exercised great influence, and that over me, she exercised the spell of fascination. No other word will explain her influence. For it was not based on excellences such as the mind could recognize to be attractions. It was based on a mysterious personal power, something awful in its mysteriousness, as all demoniac powers are. One source of her influence over men I think I can explain. She at once captivated and repelled them. By artful appeals to their vanity, she made them interested in her, and in her opinion of them, and yet kept herself inaccessible by a pride which was the more fascinating, because it always seemed about to give way. Her instinct fastened upon the weak point in those she approached. This made her seductive to men, because she flattered their weak points, and hateful to women, because she flouted and disclosed their weak points. Her influence over me began in the following way. One day, at a picnic, having been led by her into a conversation respecting the relative inferiority of the feminine intellect, I was forced to speak rather more earnestly than usual, when suddenly she turned to me, and exclaimed in a lower voice, "I am willing to credit anything you say, only pray don't continue talking to me so earnestly." Apostrophe, why not? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked, surprised. She looked at me with peculiar significance, but remained silent. May I ask why not? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. Because, if you do, somebody may be jealous. Apostrophe, there was a laughing defiance in her eye as she spoke. And pray, who has a right to be jealous of me? Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh, you know well enough. Apostrophe, it was true. I did know, and she knew, that I knew it. To my shame, be it said, that I was weak enough to yield to an equivocation which I now see to have been disloyal, but which I then pretended to have been no more than delicacy to Audley. As, in point of fact, there had never been a word passed between us respecting our mutual feelings, I considered myself bound in honor to assume that there was nothing tacitly acknowledged. Piqued by her tone and look, I disavowed the existence of any claims upon my attention, and to prove the sincerity of my words, I persisted in addressing my attentions to her. Once or twice I fancied I caught flying glances, in which some of the company criticized my conduct, and Audley also seemed to me unusually quiet. But her manner, though quiet, was untroubled and unchanged. I talked less to her than usual, partly because I talked so much to Agalma, and partly because I felt that Agalma's eyes were on us. But no shadow of temper or reserve darkened our interchange of speech. On our way back, I know not what devil prompted me to ask Agalma whether she had really been in earnest in her former allusion to somebody. Apostrophe, yes, apostrophe, she said, I was in earnest then. Apostrophe, and now? Apostrophe, apostrophe, now I have doubts. I may have been misinformed. It's no concern of mine, anyway, but I had been given to understand. However, I admit that my own eyes have not confirmed what my ears heard. Apostrophe, this speech was irritating on two separate grounds. It implied that people were talking freely of my attachment, which, until I had formally acknowledged it, I resented as an impertinence. And it implied that, from personal observation, Agalma doubted Audley's feelings for me. This alarmed my quick retreating pride. I too, began to doubt. Once let loose on that field, imagination soon saw shapes enough to confirm any doubt. Audley's manner certainly had seemed less tender, nay, somewhat indifferent during the last few days. Had the arrival of that heavy lout, her cousin, anything to do with this change? Not to weary you, by recalling all the unfolding stages of this miserable story with the minuteness of detail which my own memory morbidly lingers on, I will hurry to the catastrophe. I grew more and more doubtful of the existence in Audley's mind of any feeling stronger than friendship for me, and as this doubt strengthened, there arose the flattering suspicion that I was becoming an object of greater interest to Agalma, who had quite changed her tone towards me, and had become serious in her speech and manner. Weeks passed. Adelie had fallen from her pedestal, and had taken her place among agreeable acquaintances. One day I suddenly learned that Adelie was engaged to her cousin. You will not wonder that Agalma, who before this had exercised great fascination over me, now doubly became an object of the most tender interest. I fell madly in love. Hitherto I had never known that passion. My feeling for Adelie, I saw, was but the inarticulate stammerings of the mighty voice which now sounded throughout the depths of my nature. The phrase, madly in love, is no exaggeration. Madness alone knows such a fever of the brain, such a tumult of the heart. It was not that reason was overpowered. On the contrary, reason was intensely active, but active with that logic of flames which lights up the vision of maniacs. Although, of course, my passion was but too evident to everyone, I dreaded its premature avowal, lest I should lose her, and almost equally dreaded delay, lest I should suffer from it also. At length the avowal was extorted from me by jealousy of a brilliant Paul Kerensky who had recently appeared in our circle, and was obviously casting me in the shade by his superior advantages of novelty, of personal attraction, and of a romantic history. She accepted me, and now, for a time, I was the happiest of mortals. The fever of the last few weeks was abating, it gave place to a deep tide of hopeful joy. Could I have died then? Could I have even died shortly afterwards, when I knew the delicious mystery of a jealousy not too absorbing? For you must know that my happiness was brief. Jealousy, to which all passion of a deep and exacting power is inevitably allied, soon began to disturb my content. Agalma had no tenderness. She permitted caresses, never returned them. She was ready enough to listen to all my plans for the future, so long as the recital moved amid the tales of fortune, and her position in society, that is, so long as her vanity was interested. But I began to observe with pain that her thoughts never rested on tender domesticities and poetic anticipations. This vexed me more and more. The very spell which she exercised over me made her want of tenderness more intolerable. I yearned for her love for some sympathy with the vehement passion which was burning within me, and she was as marble. You will not be surprised to hear that I reproached her bitterly for her indifference. That is the invariable and fatal folly of lovers. They seem to imagine that a heart can be scalded into tenderness. To my reproaches she at first answered impatiently that they were unjust, that it was not her fault if her nature was less expansive than mine, and that it was insulting to be told she was indifferent to the man whom she had consented to marry. Later she answered my reproaches with haughty defiance, one day intimating that if I really thought what I said, and repented our engagement, it would be most prudent for us to separate ere it was too late. This quieted me for a while, but it brought no balm to my wounds. And now fresh tortures were added. Kerensky became quite marked in his attentions to Agalma. These she received with evident delight, so much so that I saw by the glances of others that they were scandalized at it. And this, of course, increased my pain. My renewed reproaches only made her manner colder to me. To Kerensky it became what I would gladly have seen towards myself. The stress and agitation of those days were too much for me. I fell ill, and for 7 weeks lay utterly prostrate. On recovering, this note was handed to me. It was from Agalma. Berganov here held out to me a crumpled letter, and motioned that I should open it and read. It ran thus. I have thought much of what you have so often said, that it would be for the happiness of both, if our unfortunate engagement were set aside. That you have a real affection for me, I believe, and be assured that I once had a real affection for you. Not, perhaps, the passionate love which a nature so exacting as yours demands, and which I earnestly hope it may one day find, but a genuine affection nevertheless, which would have made me proud to share your lot. But it would be uncandid in me to pretend that this now exists. Your incessant jealousy, the angry feelings excited by your approaches, the fretful irritation in which for some time we have lived together, has completely killed what love I had, and I no longer feel prepared to risk the happiness of both of us by a marriage. What you said the other night convinces me that it is even your desire our engagement should cease. It is certainly mine. Let us try to think kindly of each other and meet again as friends. Agalma Liebenstein. When I had read this, and returned it to him, he said, "You see that this was written on the day I was taken ill. Whether she knew that I was helpless I know not. At any rate, she never sent to inquire after me. She went off to Paris, Kerensky followed her, and as I quickly learned on going once more into society they were married. Did you ever, in the whole course of your experience, hear of such heartless conduct?" Berganov asked this with a ferocity which quite startled me. I did not answer him, for, in truth, I could not see that Agalma had been very much to blame, even as he told the story, and felt sure that could I have heard her version it would have worn a very different aspect. That she was cold and disappointed him might be true enough, but there was no crime. And I perfectly understood how thoroughly odious he must have made himself to her by his exactions and reproaches. I understood this, perhaps, all the better, because in the course of his narrative Berganov had revealed to me aspects of his nature which were somewhat repulsive. Especially was I struck with his morbid vanity, and his readiness to impute low motives to others. This unpleasant view of his character, a character in many respects, so admirable for its generosity and refinement, was deepened as he went on, instead of awaiting my reply to his question. "For a wrong so measureless, you will naturally ask what measureless revenge I sought. The idea had not occurred to me, indeed I could see no wrong, and this notion of revenge was somewhat startling in such a case. I debated it long," he continued. "I felt that, since I was prevented from arresting any of the evil to myself, I could at least mature my plans for an adequate discharge of just retributions on her. It reveals the impotence resulting from the trammels of modern civilization, that while the possibilities of wrong are infinite, the openings for vengeance are few and contemptible. Only when a man is thrown upon the necessities of this wild justice, does he discover how difficult vengeance really is. Had Agalma been my wife, I could have wreaked my wrath upon her, with assurance that some of the torture she inflicted on me was to fall on her. Not having this power, what was I to do? Kill her? That would have afforded one moment of exquisite satisfaction, but to her, it would have been simply death and I wanted to kill the heart. He seemed working with an insane passion, so that I regarded him with disgust, mingled with some doubts, as to what horrors he was about to relate. My plan was chosen. The only way to reach her heart was to strike through her husband. For several hours daily I practiced with the pistol, until in spite of only having a left hand I acquired fatal skill. But this was not enough. Firing at a mark is simple work. Firing at a man, especially one holding a pistol pointed at you, is altogether different. I had too often heard of crack shots missing their men, to rely confidently on my skill in the shooting gallery. It was necessary that my eye and hand should be educated to familiarity with the real object. Part of the cause why duelists miss their man is from the trepidation of fear. I was without fear. At no moment in my life have I been afraid. And the chance of being shot by Kerensky I counted as nothing. The other cause is unfamiliarity with the mark. This I secured myself against by getting a lay figure of Kerensky's height, dressing it to resemble him, placing a pistol in its hand, and then practicing at this mark in the woods. After a short time I could send a bullet through the thorax without taking more than a hasty glance at the figure. Thus prepared, I started for Paris. But you will feel for me when you learn that my hungry heart was baffled of its vengeance, and baffled forever. Agalma had been carried off by scarlet fever. Kerensky had left Paris, and I felt no strong promptings to follow him and wreak on him a futile vengeance. It was on her my wrath had been concentrated, and I gnashed my teeth at the thought that she had escaped me. My story is ended. The months of gloomy depression which succeeded, now that I was no longer sustained by the hope of vengeance, I need not speak of. My existence was desolate, and even now the desolation continues over the whole region of the emotions. I carry a dead heart within me. Via a second victim, Berganov's story has been narrated with some fullness, though in less detail than he told it, in order that the reader may understand its real bearings on my story. Without it, the motives which impelled the strange pertinacity of my pursuit would have been unintelligible. I have said that a very disagreeable impression remained on my mind respecting certain aspects of his character, and I felt somewhat ashamed of my imperfect sagacity in having up to this period been entirely blind to those aspects. The truth is, every human being is a mystery, and remains so to the last. We fancy we know a character, we form a distinct conception of it. For years that conception remains unmodified, and suddenly the strain of some emergency, of the incidental stimulus of new circumstances, reveals qualities not simply unexpected, but flatly contradictory of our previous conception. We judge of a man by the angle he subtends to our eye, only thus can we judge of him. And this angle depends on the relation his qualities and circumstances bear to our interests and sympathies. Berganov had charmed me intellectually. Morally, I had never come closer to him than in the sympathies of public questions and abstract theories. His story had disclosed hidden depths. My old suspicions reappeared, and a conversation we had 2 days afterwards helped to strengthen them. We had gone on a visit to Schwanthaler, the sculptor, at his tiny little castle of Schwaneck, a few miles from Munich. The artist was out for a walk, but we were invited to come in and await his return, which would be shortly, and meanwhile Berganov undertook to show me over the castle, interesting as a bit of modern Gothic, realizing on a diminutive scale a youthful dream of the sculptor's. When our survey was completed, and it did not take long, we sat at one of the windows, and enjoyed a magnificent prospect. "It is curious," said Berganov, "to be shut up here in this imitation of Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.